Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 171, I answer questions from the chat room with Robert Herron. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 7th, 2013, episode 171, chat room Q&A with Robert Herron. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit htg.ting.com. That's htg.ting.com. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the promo code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Robert Herron, technologist extraordinaire and co-host of the HD Nation podcast on Revision 3. Hey, Robert, welcome back to the show.
Scott, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always great to have you here. You and I always have a great time together, so I'm real happy to have you on again.
And I truly appreciate your podcast, too. I listen to it all the time. It's one of the few podcasts I do regularly listen to, and I always learn something. So,
well, thank you so much. I do check out yours as well. I love the product reviews and the great banter that you and Patrick have back and forth. It's really fun.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so today we have a special show. Robert and I are going to be answering questions from the chat room. And there are going to be quite a few of them, I'm sure. There already have been in the pre-show hours. But before we do, I did want to take just a couple moments. Robert, you've got some exciting news. You've got the Home Theater Geeks Dream Project coming right up here in the next day or so.
Yes, I finally decided to get with it and get a real AV receiver for my home theater setup here. And nothing too extravagant, so it was like a balance between value and just good quality. And I ended up buying a new AVR from Yamaha, the RX-V575. Kind of a mid-range product from them. It does feature 4K pass-through, but it doesn't actually perform upscaling of the inputs. Mm-hmm. That really wasn't that important to me. So that's why I went with that. Also, because it had actual binding posts on the back of the AVR. I kept moving up in quality until at least it had that on all 7-dot plus inputs or outputs for the speakers.
Outputs. Yeah, I agree with you completely. When you go into the really cheap end of the AV receiver market, you get these spring clips that are pretty funky. So that's, in fact, one of the sort of bottom line criteria that I recommend to people is you need to spend enough on an AV receiver to get those real binding posts, because you're going to get a much better connection to the speaker wire. And it's just it indicates a certain level of quality, a build quality that I think is really important. So I commend you for doing that. I also have to commend you. You and I obviously have the same sort of philosophy. I tend to populate my theater with, you know, modest products. I mean, you and I both probably could get pretty high-end stuff, but I like to live where a lot of people live and see what a reasonable amount of money can get you and how much value you can get out of it. So I applaud you for doing that. Absolutely.
Exactly, because I do have the opportunity to test really expensive products as well as more value-oriented products as well. And for the home environment I'm setting up, I didn't really want to go all out because I wanted something I hadn't heard before as far as speakers, in terms of speaker selection goes, but also something that wasn't so off the deep end that most people were like, I ain't going there. And it wouldn't be relevant for a lot of people. So it was a balancing act between those two items. What with the Energy 5.1 Take Classics?
Excellent.
I've read so many reviews highlighting their performance at the price point they were talking about. And although it doesn't have binding posts on the speakers themselves, it's still, though, the reviews are to the point where I'm like, okay, I have to listen to these. And I ended up going with that. And in addition to some Sanus-based speaker stands and lots of at least 100 feet of good copper 14-gauge wire for that as well. And actual banana clips, too. I don't know what you think about banana clips into
binding
posts.
I like banana plugs. I do. No, I really do like banana plugs. Yeah, I do like them. There are audiophiles who don't like them very much, but they're certainly so much more convenient than bare wire. And I don't have a problem with them. They make a good connection as far as I'm concerned. I use them myself. So totally. I think you were right there.
I'm also looking forward to just to getting rid of a few things. Like I have a old HDMI switch that I've had for a while. I'll be able to eliminate that and use the one built into the AVR. Just being able to redo all the wiring. I am going to lose some wireless rear speakers on an old set I had, but I don't even care about that. Also, the unit I am picking up, the AVR or the AV receiver from Yamaha, isn't wireless enabled. So, but that doesn't matter because I run a hard wire to a switch into the back of my rack anyway. So
you're talking about Ethernet now?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So everything's just Ethernet connected in my home. Very few things are actually wireless, save for the Chromecast unit that I have. And it turns out the AV receiver has a USB port on the back that will supply power to that device, which I will occupy in one of the HDMI ports on that. So
wow, well that's going to be really super cool. We are pre-recording this show, and it will actually be aired after the podcast that I do with a couple of people who already now have the Chromecast and have some experience with it. So we're going to talk all about Chromecast on episode number 170. So once you see this show, that will already have been posted. And I do hope you'll check that out because there'll be a lot of information about Chromecast. Have you actually played with Chromecast yet, or are you waiting for your receiver to start that up?
Oh, no. I immediately plugged that in and went to town. Mm-hmm. I probably watched more Netflix in the last couple of days than I recall, at least streaming Netflix content in the last couple of days through that device than I have in recent memory. And with my Android phone, it was very easy to set up. I did have a couple of weird issues with my wireless network, and it turned out I had things like AP isolation enabled and other tech on my router that needed to be disabled first in order to get the initial setup done. Mm-hmm. But once that was set up and rolling, it works like a charm. But I also discovered if you have a newer TV with Netflix or YouTube built in, mm-hmm. you can do a very similar experience where just by launching the app, once you pair it to your TV, once you launch the app on your phone and say send it to the TV, it will automatically launch the app and start playing it, very similar to what Chromecast is currently doing. So for the current functionality, if you have a newer TV, you pretty much are seeing what the experience is right now, or you have that capability at least to take advantage of.
What is and the TV also, you have that'll do that?
It was somebody wrote me saying they had a brand new LG flat panel. And I tried it out on a new Samsung F6400 LED. And I also have the new F8500 I'm testing right now. And I'm sure it'll
top of the line plasma.
Holy cow, is that TV amazing? Mm. I just have to say that is. Although out of the box, it wasn't so hot, but it calibrated quite nicely, beautifully. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in awe of how bright that is for a plasma display.
Yes, yes. That is its real claim to fame, aside from the fact that you do also get great black levels. But yeah, it goes significantly brighter than just about any plasma that's been made up to this point. So if you're going to put a plasma in a room with some ambient light in it, that's the one to get, clearly.
I agree. If light's an issue and you still want that, you want that plasma experience, but you know, you're concerned about light output, that is the one to beat right now. I don't believe there's any other plasma out there coming out this year that will match that or exceed its ability to put light out in the room.
No, I agree. I agree completely. Okay, great. Well, let us get to some questions here in the chat room. And let me see if I can find some here. In fact, here's the first one from Mr. V. Best plasma, Samsung F8500 or Panasonic VT60? Looking to buy in the next couple of weeks. Now, there's the VT60 and even a higher end than that, the ZT60, which is about $500 more than the VT50. I've seen all three of them actually next to each other.
Oh, excellent.
But it was in a very dark room, and they were all calibrated to the same peak brightness, about 32 or 35 foot Lambert, something like that. So they were all right together, right next to each other, and next to a Kuro, in fact, over at Tom Norton's house. He's the senior video editor at Home Theater Magazine and HomeTheater.com, and he's been on the show before. And he had all these TVs in for review, and I went over, and he just had them right next to each other, and it was really pretty cool to see them. I don't know. Tell me what you think. I'm tending to think you can't go wrong either way, really.
Yeah, if money's the issue, I'd go the VT60. Then if I really wanted that extra light output, I'd probably swing up to the F8500 from Samsung. And then finally the ZT60, just if you wanted to say, I just simply want arguably one of the best constructed plasmas from arguably the masters of plasma. That ZT60 is their pride and joy. And for this year, at least.
Man, it really looks good. There's no question about it. But it doesn't put out the same amount of light that the F8500 does, the Samsung. So once again, if you need that light output, the Samsung's the way to go. And if you know, the difference in black level between the three was pretty minuscule. Tom measured, I think, 0.0012 on the Samsung and 0.0017 on the Panasonic. And 0.0017 on the Samsung, something like that. So there wasn't much of a difference. Side by side, you could see it. But very few people actually look at them side by side in a dark room. If they're going to be side by side, they're going to be in a retail showroom, which is flooded with light.
And I will say for that Samsung F8500, I was looking at the 64-inch version, and it's about $3,400 online right now. So it's definitely up at the higher end of pricing among all plasmas out there. And there aren't that many screen sizes really either. I mean, it goes up to 64 inches or you have a 60 and a 51 or something like that as well.
Yeah. See, that's the other difference
If the app experience is important, it just in sheer number of apps and maybe future upgradability because it has the kit on the back that you can add. The Samsung display does for, is it the Evolution kit? No, it's the,
oh yeah, yeah. No, it's called the One Connect.
Yeah, being able to upgrade the panel down the road, that's something else if it's important to you. But
you're
otherwise,
exactly right. In fact, that's pretty important, more so for these new Ultra HD panels that are coming out. I mean, it's true also for the 1080p plasmas that we have now for the next few years. Generically, it's known as the Evolution Kit. You're exactly right.
Gotcha.
And in fact, of the Samsung, of the plasma, the F8500 and so on, I think that's, in fact, its official name. And what it'll give you in the future is more apps, maybe better video processing, things that will require some hardware, HDMI 2.0 when that becomes available, although that's not going to be that important, again, for a 1080p set. It's going to be more important for a UHD panel, which Samsung has in the 55 and 65-inch sizes.
And comparing plasmas again between Samsung and Panasonic, the Samsung F8500 at least features a built-in HD camera. I believe it's a 720p camera only, but if you want to do Skype built into your TV, the pop-up camera on that set's awfully convenient. However, I will say that as far as the look of the app screens and the ability to customize them and just the overwhelming nature sometimes I find with Samsung's app selection, there's just so much stuff there. The Panasonic TV is refreshingly clean in terms of the interface and your ability to customize it the way you want. And for that, I am just eternally grateful when I see designs like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree. I saw a question here. Oh, Mr. Mike in the chat room. My TV doesn't have enough HDMI inputs for Chromecast, gaming units, etc. How can I use my receiver? Or I know I can use a receiver, but they're costly. Wonder if you've tried a mono price switcher or something like that. Have you tried you mentioned you had an HDMI switcher, an older one.
Oh, yeah. I have one of the original DVD-O Edges. I also have an Edge Green. Those are pretty pricey. However, there's for under $10, you can get a 3-port switch on Amazon. I was just looking at one that I actually own. It's in another room right now. But it even features it's a cable on one end, and it's got 3 ports on the other. And it auto-switches based on what device is turned on. And you could plug that into one of your inputs on your TV. And then you'll have 3 additional ports. And then if it's a device that'll turn on and off fully, that's the best case scenario, because then as you turn them off, it'll automatically switch over to whatever other active port is enabled currently. Other than that, there are some great brands as well that are in the like, say, the $30 to $40 range. They'll get you up to like 5 ports if you really need a lot. or if you're dealing with multiple outputs, say you've got a projector and a flat panel in the same room and you go back and forth between them depending on the lighting conditions, you'll want something like a matrix switch where it features two outputs that might be simultaneously enabled, or you can configure it to do whatever output you want. And in that case, then you can easily route your video the way you need it to, depending on which display device you're using. And those devices, generally speaking, are all pretty rock solid. I have found that a lot of the HDMI switches, the cheaper ones, won't work with 4K signals. They're just not, the bandwidth isn't there in order to handle it properly. But they should, and I'm sure in the next generation of these products too, you'll see it. But go do a search on Amazon. There's that one with the cable on it already. That's the one port you plug into the TV, and then it has three additional outputs or inputs, excuse me, for receiving. And I think it was like $8, and it's still working, and I've had it for almost a year now. So it's a terrific piece of hardware at a really affordable price. So don't ever think that if you've run out of HDMI ports or you have one or two on your TV that you're stuck with that. You don't need an AV receiver, although I highly recommend it for audio quality. Things like Blu-ray have brought new formats, specifically the lossless audio formats like Dolby True HD and DTS HD Master Audio that are an ear candy for any movie lover. And if you're not yet experiencing that, even if you have a 5.1 setup, if you that move from Dolby Digital, say, to Dolby Digital True HD is a leap in quality, and it's really worth enjoying. And it is more than half the experience.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of people say audio is more than half the experience. And I can certainly understand the argument. I myself am pretty videophiliac, as it were. But certainly the audio is at least half the experience. And certainly there's a big leap from Dolby Digital to Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio, both of which are lossless, which means you don't lose any audio quality from the compression, whereas Dolby Digital and regular DTS throw away quite a bit of the audio, which the algorithm thinks you won't hear anyway. And in some sense, you don't. But there's also just a loss of impact, a loss of real, I don't know, what would you call it?
For me, it was just how much more detailed sounds are. You don't realize the subtleties in sound that you're missing on a more compressed sound source. It's the same thing, really, with going from an MP3 to CD audio to now we're seeing lossless formats coming out for audio tracks on Blu-ray formats now, getting up to, I think, 2496.
24 bits, 96 or kilohertz.
Exactly. I can't wait to give those a listen, and hopefully more audio tracks will be released in that format as well. But and the one thing I'm surprised kind of mildly is that the next gen gaming consoles aren't doing anything as far as expanding into a lossless audio format. I've heard off the record that there's just simply a problem is it's too much data for the given memory footprint of these consoles is why they're not addressing it. I can't believe that's really the issue. Maybe it's a licensing thing or something, but I'd like to see the gaming industry move into lossless audio tracks as well, because they're already fully supporting usually multiple audio codecs like DTS and Dolby Digital in their current crop of games, and that's a place where you really want good surround sound. And although I find, you know, movies and the cinematic experience is really a good showcase for lossless formats, I think gaming, it should be just considered at least as important, especially if there's room on the disc for the content, and if the console can actually support it, then they should just be doing it.
Right. I totally agree. And who knows, maybe we'll see it in the PS4 or the Xbox One, which are the next consoles to come out in the next few months, I've heard. At AVS Forum, I'm starting to place a lot more emphasis on video games because a lot of people play them. And so we're doing video game reviews. We're starting to do video game reviews in which we not only evaluate the gameplay and the quality of the game and whether it makes sense and how fun it is, but also the audio and video quality of the game. Excellent. And so there's where we're going to start seeing a lot of calls for, hey, let's get the audio a little better here. Now, Mark Daria, my primary game reviewer right now, he reviewed The Last of Us, which is apparently a big game coming out. I'm not a gamer, so it's not something you're going to see my name on, but I do recognize the importance of it. And in this game called The Last of Us, he gave the audio something like 100 or very close to a perfect score because he thought it was really killer. So I'm hopeful that we will see better audio coming out of games in the future.
And I do want to say I did come across the game somebody pointed out to me that may have been a lossless audio track on it in LPCM format. I'm not sure if it was a lossless track or not, but at least it offered it in that format. And I'd be curious. I want to say it was Uncharted 2, somebody pointed out to me. And that's the one example I can point out. But I have The Last of Us, and I have yet to get into it. It's a little, it's a wee bit violent, and I just wasn't in the mood for that after finishing BioShock. So
we've got a review of BioShock.
I was going to say, if you have the opportunity, though, go ahead and try out Journey on the PS3. That's a very atmospheric game, and it's very well done. And the audio in that game, too, as you run around the desert and climb the various obstacles that are in front of you, it's well done that way. And it might be a good way to get into it. And it's not a Twitch game, and it's not something you have to really struggle with. The more time you spend with it, of course, the more interesting it gets. But still, I think it might be a good starter game.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm absolutely not into violent games, which is why I probably will never look at The Last of Us, because I've heard it's very violent. Now, Mark went into the game and said, look, yes, it's very violent, but there's a lot more to it. The character development is actually quite deep. So there's a lot more to it than just shooting zombies. Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. But I'm still not into shooting zombies. I'll be more into, you know, the thought-provoking games and the more intellectually challenging rather than, you know, how many zombies can you shoot?
Exactly. I'm still playing a lot of Civilization V lately. I don't know why, but I keep going back to that. The world, the ancient world remapped, or I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Got a question a while ago. I can't seem to find it at the moment, but what do you think of Onkyo receivers? I've generally thought they've been very good.
Yeah, I have really no known issues with that, other than I know there seem to be a lot of HDMI problems going around where the HDMI switchers on those products, I'm not going to say they were failing left and right, but I ran into a couple that did, and they were eventually, I believe Onkyo was actually just providing a fix, even if it was out of warranty, and I had to handle a couple of those for clients, and that would be the one thing I was a little concerned about. And I don't know if the issue with capacitors bursting is still a remaining issue in electronics. It seems like that crops up every now and then. Ooh. But it's just, if you buy a product and the HDMI switch in it goes after a couple of years or less, that's concerning. But that's just personal anecdotal, and I can't say that happens across the board for a lot of people, but I did run into a couple of that specific brand, and but otherwise good. And we did get it repaired, and it's still functioning, so you know, at least we had good customer support from the company, and that's also important when you're shopping.
Really important. Yeah, that's great to know. Okay, before we continue, I'd like to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Ting is a no BS mobile service. It's really an MVNO, or a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network. There are no contracts or early termination fees, no bundling or ride-along services, no overage charges or penalties. If you use more than you thought you would, you just pay for it. No add-on charges for voicemail, caller ID, any of that kind of stuff. No mysterious line items in your bill. And you can even get unlimited devices on one plan. You can have as many as you want, sharing pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes. Each device on a plan costs a flat $6 a month. There's a powerful online account control panel, no holds barred customer support. Just call 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern time, and a real person will pick up the phone. How often does that happen? There's also great online customer support as well. First, you purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you'll receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device and have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Ting will break your rates out in minutes, text messages, and megabytes and bill you at the end of the month for whatever you've used. Very simple. Visit Ting today at htg.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Now, Home Theater Geeks viewers can also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit htg.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWiT network. Okay, we were talking about Onkyo receivers. Arthur D. says, my Onkyo receiver runs hot. Too hot to hold in your hand. And it's not in a closed cabinet. I was told by Onkyo this is common. Is this your experience? I don't have enough experience with Onkyo receivers myself to say. Robert, what do you think?
Just make sure it's well ventilated. And it also depends, too, if you're dealing with a dusty living room environment or lots of pets. I don't believe there's active fans in any AVR that I'm aware of. So
it'd be too loud.
Could be. Also, you could actually add a fan in your rack in order to help circulate air more efficiently, but you shouldn't have to. I really wouldn't worry about it as long as the outside is the vents are exposed. There's nothing stacked on it, covering, sealing it at least. And for that, unless you're getting airs or the thing is like shutting itself off due to overheating or something like that. But the only other thing I would maybe recommend is put a power meter on it, like a Watts Up device, and just to make sure that it's not going crazy, exceeding what it should be drawing as far as current goes.
Good quest. Good point. Yeah, absolutely. CompuVision in the chat room. CompuVision. Yeah, that's right. Has a couple of questions about HTPCs. And I know you're a big HTPC guy, so let me shoot this one over to you. If I get an HD Home Run Prime, Gigabit Ethernet, and an iOmega Lenovo Store Center NAS, network attached storage, will my old 2.8 gigahertz Pentium 4 machine be fast enough to manage three recordings at once? Are recordings sent directly to the NAS or through the PC?
It depends how you set it up.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff there.
If you're using Windows Media Center, I believe that once you select a storage spot for your video, you shouldn't change it. Otherwise, you run the risk of losing the authorization to play it back for things that are protected in terms of protected content. However, you should be able to use, if you can access your NAS from your HTPC, you should be able to then store to that as you would, you know, anything else.
It goes directly there, you think?
Yeah. You basically just have a folder or however you want to do it set up on the on your NAS device and just have that set up as the storage location. I wouldn't do it as a mapping a drive letter. I would do it strictly to the address itself. I find that if you map a drive letter, weird things can start happening. It's best to do a direct network address right to the folder or the space. You're probably going to do this to a folder. Do it to that folder in terms of your storage. Ideally, it'd be probably better just to put a 2 gig drive or a 2 terabyte drive or larger on there and just record to your heart's content. That will hold quite a bit of content locally and the speed too. If you, like I do, I have my NAS devices set to spin down when there's no activity. However, when it goes to, say, access a movie or something stored on my NAS, it'll take a second to fire back up or a few seconds before it's up and running again. And if that delay is unacceptable, there's another reason to go with local storage as well. The HD Home Run Prime, though, the 3-tuner system on a network is awfully convenient because then you can pretty much put that anywhere, well, wherever your cable connection will be, that will connect to it. But then that's a network device. And then you can use that with other devices in your home, maybe a notebook computer or your home theater PC itself. So I'm a big fan of network tuners. They're awfully convenient when it comes to just the flexibility of being able to access that video on your local network. To do anything else outside the home would require other software or setups, but that's not a bad setup you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you think the 2.8 gigahertz Pentium 4 is up to the task here?
I would, although that's probably more than you need, and it doesn't sound like it's going to be very energy efficient, depending on, I'm trying to remember which Pentium 4 that is. Hopefully it's not that, I think it was the D model that was incredibly hot and one of the most power-hungry ones ever. You just don't need that kind of power. I'm running my current home theater PC with multiple tuners, on a i3 processor, actually. Actually, it was one of the first Sandy Bridge processors. But what's considered a pretty much an energy-efficient, low-powered processor. It's nothing too fancy. It is dual-core, but that's about it. Again, you really don't need much. Even the write speed for recording multiple simultaneous high-definition shows isn't all that great. Your home network should be able to handle that on a 100 megabit connection, let alone a gigabit Ethernet connection if you've got that going. But those are really the only concerns you have. It sounds like you got plenty of CPU power. It's just if you plan to use this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, consider too how efficient is it, just so you can reduce not only just energy consumption, but maybe also fan noise too might be another issue if you're running a hot processor. That's just something I can't tolerate. It has to be at a low hum at the worst. Nothing more than I've heard from, say, like a standard set-top box or Blu-ray player in terms of fan noise or just system noise in general.
Right. The original, as I recall, the original PS3 was really noisy.
That original Xbox was crazy loud, too.
Oh, Xbox. Okay, okay.
That was the one where I just... Actually, it was the new Xbox, the 360 even. The original one of that was crazy loud. And I ended up waiting to the very last generation of that product. There probably is another generation now, I'm sure. But they've quieted that one down. And apparently the new Xbox One is going to be exceptionally quiet as far as it's built from the ground up to be, you know, one big radiator. So without a lot of fan noise.
Yeah.
So they're going to, I imagine it's going to be quiet as can be.
Now, Beatmaster in the chat room is asking, what's the current best high-end media player? Now, putting the two terms high-end and media player together might be a little tricky, because most media players these days are like, what, $100 or less? And the Chromecast is $35.
That's what I'm thinking.
Is there any reason to have a high-end, what we might call a high-end media player? Like the Kaleidoscape, for example. There's an example of a high-end media player.
And they actually have some new, more affordable products they've recently announced too. And that's basically a disc movie server that rips your content and will serve it up with beautiful background jewel case interface and all of that. But it depends too what kind of media you're talking about. And as long as the device supports the formats you need, that's the ideal product. And it does so with the performance and the interface that you want. That's really all I'm looking for. I mean, the WDTV Live products,
Western Digital.
It supports, I think, even FLAC files, which most of my audio collection's in. That I absolutely love. And basically, if it can do that, that's all I would care about. And then can it feed a nice, clean signal to my AV receiver? And if it can do those things, that to me would be the best one. Now, if you're talking portable players, there are some brands out there that do support more lossless formats than others, if that's what you're aiming at.
Right. But as far lossless audio, as, of course.
Totally. And then, but for video, it's going to be Blu-ray when it comes right down to it. There's nothing better yet in terms of the content that we're seeing, except for maybe I haven't seen Sony's streaming 4K stuff. Hopefully we'll see that.
Hopefully we'll see yes, exactly. Somebody before the show started asked a question about the Sony 4K or UHD would be a more accurate way to say it. Ultra HD. True. Server and their download service. Sony's made a big deal since CES last January about what they want to do, how they want to deliver UHD content, native UHD content, is downloading it from the internet into a big hard drive server rather than a physical disk, which doesn't exist, or streaming, which would require very high bandwidth into the home. And so somebody in the chat room asked just before the show about, had we seen the Sony server and TV system work? I haven't. I doubt you have either.
Seen it in action?
Yeah.
Not yet. And the other thing is, Sony's player currently, at least as far as Sony's reported, it only works with Sony TVs. It's bound to their products.
Yep.
However, depending on whatever bit rates they're delivering, you know, and whatever formats they're using currently, I'd be curious to know those specs. But I believe the product is for sale now, and it's going to be Sony-owned titles, of course.
Yep.
So the selection is going to be pretty limited. So the Red unit, I believe, is now shipping limited select clientele who pre-ordered that baby. And I'm wondering whose content are they serving?
I have an answer for that, actually.
Excellent.
Last week, I got a press release that there is actually a 4K or UHD service company that beat Sony to the punch, became the first service to actually download a UHD movie to a Red-Ray player over the internet to a consumer who then played it on their Sony UHD TV.
That's awesome.
It is. It is awesome. The company that did it is a company called Odemax, Odemax.com. Now, their catalog of titles is all independent. There's nothing mainstream there at all. But they beat Sony to the punch. They actually downloaded this file, which, and this movie called The Ballad of Danko Jones, which is about, which stars this, a real life band, a Canadian rock band called Danko Jones, after its lead guitar and vocalist, whose alt name is also Danko Jones. Anyway, it's a 23-minute short, which they shot on red cameras, I'm sure, at 4K, 5K, actually, red cameras are, and then converted it to UHD, encoded it in the Red codec, and downloaded it over the internet, became the first company to do so. It was, I think they said, a 3-gigabyte file. It's 23 minutes long, 3-gigabyte file, took an hour and a half to download into the Red Ray player.
Not bad.
Not bad. And they said even at that, it was kind of an earlier version. They didn't compress it as much as they could have. And they can now do 90-minute files to a 6-gigabyte size. It's 90-minute movies, I mean, to a 6-gigabyte file size, which would take about 3 hours then to download, using a standard Time Warner cable internet interface.
Nice. If they could do a little P2P technology with that, that might speed it up a little bit and help distribute the load. Maybe they have a little code on the back end for that particular server that would help with that. I downloaded a 42 gig file the other day, and it took about 4 hours. So, and that was on about 3 megs per second. So, I see a future for these streaming technologies. And for me, it's going to be about quality. If I'm subscribing to a quad HD or UHD stream or service, it better be looking better than the Blu-ray and in every way, shape, or form. No compression artifacts, high quality audio, and ease of use, too. I don't mind waiting a few hours or queue up some stuff to download, and then I'll come back later and watch it.
Exactly. So. Or even do it overnight, and then so you have it the next day.
Totally.
Yeah. Now, from everything I have read from people who have seen it, the Red codec is actually very good. But the Red Ray player requires the Red codec, and almost the rest of the universe is probably going to go with this H.265 compression. So this will be kind of an interesting thing to look at. Sony undoubtedly is going with H.265. But everybody that I've talked to that's seen the Red codec says, man, you can compress the heck out of that thing, and it still looks great.
You figure with their experience in production and capture with their hardware, they're pretty good about storage. And if they have a format that's compressed enough to still maintain quality that they find acceptable, I think they'd be a good source of doing this. Now, if they could get the products out to more people, or if they're just going to maintain this, fairly niche product just for the higher end clientele, that remains to be seen. But at least there's more people doing it rather than just Sony, and doing it in a box that's not proprietary to one specific brand of TV.
Exactly. I think that's a really important story.
For this year, in particular, Sony's work with their 4K or mastered in 4K Blu-rays, I haven't had a chance to check one out on a Sony TV yet, but it also enables, in addition to just coming from a higher quality source at a higher bit rate for the video, it's also enabling an expanded color palette. And whether or not that's accurate or not, at least I like to see somebody pushing it in terms of, doing more with the technology we currently have available. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I do agree completely. I'm a little concerned by the fact that for video, you have a certain range of colors that you can that should be reproduced, and you want the TV to reproduce the same range of colors that were used to master the Blu-ray or the broadcast. But when you capture a movie, when you shoot a movie, you're capturing quite a larger array of colors. And one of the arguments by Sony and Panasonic both, saying, oh, well, we can produce a wider range of colors, and our, in the case of Sony, this mastered in 4K Blu-rays actually expands the color gamut out to match that so that it more closely matches the movie, the original movie. Well, that's a good intent, but how do we know what color red was intended, for example, or blue or green or anything else? It's kind of making an educated guess, and so I'm a little wary of that.
Yeah, we are kind of also just depending on Sony's factory setup of that TV and the content in terms of it playing back on that TV, triggering the right response out of this, out of the display. Sony's production cameras, or they're like, they're, I'm thinking specifically of the F65, that Wonder camera of theirs.
Yes.
That is capable of recording a gamut that exceeds everything we're currently looking at in terms of how big that triangle would be, in terms of how much color space it's actually able to capture. And apparently it's one of the few cameras out there that's set up for the Rec 2020 spec. In terms of it's a larger triangle compared to, say, the larger color space compared to, say, what we do with HDTV or standard def TV or even Blu-ray, which is based on the similar specs. So
exactly.
That these cameras are available and can capture that information is great. However, we need to be able to translate that into something that's accurate when we see it at home. That's correct. One of the reasons to still go to the movie theater, though, especially with digital projection the way it is you will get a better, more richer color experience on the screen than you can currently experience at home. And hopefully it's accurately calibrated in the theater as well.
Well, we can only hope, but that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Now, the upcoming UHD standard, which still isn't finalized in many respects, and one of them is color gamut. One of the things that we're hoping for is that they will standardize on this Rec 2020, which is much wider color gamut, a much greater range of colors than Rec 709, which is what we use now. So I'm with you. I think going to the movies has great value, and that's one of the reasons right there.
Exactly. And also, too, when you talk about color gamut, a lot of times you'll see just the extreme points of saturation mapped out on that triangle that we always talk about, or whatever shape it ends up being, depending on what it is. Realize, too, that those points, it's nice when they hit right on the spot, but that's just out at the extreme. And you really need to be able to also hit all the interior points accurately as well.
Right.
And that's something you really never, I'm seeing it more and more in reviews than I'm seeing online nowadays. And that's something I've recently added to my own testing as well, is to test more color points, do some color checking to make sure the TV is coming close or not.
And actually the new SpectraCal Calman software does that. I don't know is that what you're using?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's terrific. I have a decent color generator or a pattern generator that'll do triplets where you can say, hey, this value of red, this value of blue, this value of green, put that color up on the screen, take a measurement of it, and you can automate the process at that point. And it's great, though, for checking a bunch of different colors or a bunch of different grayscales or whatever you're trying to do.
Right. Exactly right. Chumley in the chat room is asking, I've always wanted to call in and ask about small rooms and big sound. I have my theater equipment in storage due to lack of space. Hate to go the sound bar route.
I don't blame you.
Now, you know, I don't diss sound bars particularly. You know, they are appropriate under certain conditions, and there are several that are really good right now. The new Pioneer that's coming out now, middle of next month, really sounds great. I've heard it and it's really good. But on the other hand, there's nothing like having real speakers all around you.
I completely agree. The sound bars, I will say, are simple. It's easy to set one up. And if you have anybody with like hearing issues or it will give you better sound than what's built into your TV, period. However, don't think that's the be all end all. They're, like you said, nothing beats having a good set of surround sound speakers set up. And volume, if that's an issue with your neighbors and stuff, work on making sure you want to make sure the calibration of the setup is as good as it can be. And then you can play with things like range compression to keep the neighbors from beating on the ceiling or on the floor, vice versa. You want to be a good neighbor. You try to be.
You do. Yeah.
Although if you're going to watch the movie loud, do it during the middle of the day. Just go crazy. Right.
Now, in terms of small rooms, there are some small speaker packages that work very well. You're just getting the Energy Take Classic 5.1 system, which is a very small, the main speakers are very small, and the subwoofer's not that big either.
No, and I'm dealing with a fairly small environment too. So the media room I have here in my apartment isn't gigantic by any stretch of the imagination. So I really also focus on just where the speakers are pointed, making sure they're pointed at my head and the ears, the balancing and all of the setup related to that. It's fairly easy to do, but if you do invest or you do set one of these systems up, take the time to do that right, because it's night and day in terms of how something will sound. Just small adjustments. And I mean, in terms of how you aim the speaker, how high is the speaker, how what's the level of each speaker in terms of the timing and the volume, as well as your subwoofer placement and level. There's a lot of basic stuff you can do to make it mm-hmm. better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which reminds me, I was going to ask you this question. What do you think of auto room correction systems like Odyssey? Yamaha has their own called Yamaha Acoustic Parametric Optimization, something like that. Parametric Acoustic Optimization. Most AV receivers these days have this function where you hit a button. They come with a little microphone that you plug into the receiver, and you put the microphone in the place where you're going to sit. And then you hit a button, and it runs through a series of test tones. It measures where there are acoustical anomalies and then tries to compensate for them. Have you found those to be generally beneficial? Do they generally improve the sound? A lot of people I talk to say they generally don't.
I find they'll get things like distance pretty accurate, and they'll tell you if you've got a couple of wires crossed. But I was listening to your recent podcast with the gentleman from one of the high-end speaker manufacturers recently, and you guys mm-hmm. were having this discussion, and
yeah.
that was eye-opening, really, in terms of the limitations of a single monodirectional or omnidirectional microphone, or if it's even yes. omnidirectional, I'm not even sure.
It is, but it is typically omnidirectional, yeah.
There are limits to what that can do. So at the very least, I mean, there are a couple of good sound meter apps if you can't go out and spend $20, $30 or more dollars on a sound meter. However, I've got a pretty decent sound meter that I'll run that tool just to see what it does, but mm-hmm. I in no way rely upon it in terms of the overall setup. And mm-hmm. I use my own ears, and I'll pull out the tape measure, double check everything, mm-hmm. pull out the sound meter with a good test source. I've got a couple of great discs for putting up the tones that are ideal. If you've got nothing else and you don't know what else to do, and you, especially for verifying like phase or making sure the wires were hooked up at least properly.
Right. Right.
That's where those tools are kind of handy for that. And you know what, if it gets the distance for timing right, one less thing you have to mess with, but mm-hmm. go back through it with your own sound meter sitting in your spot, and check it all before you say it's ready. And that way you'll end up being happier overall.
Yeah, good advice. Good advice. Beatmaster clarified what he was talking about in terms of high-end media servers. He meant plays one-to-one Blu-rays, which means bit-for-bit copies of Blu-rays, as well as FLAC losslessly compressed or uncompressed PCM. And I think the answer to that is Kaleidoscape.
Yeah, maybe. With Windows Media Center and a program called My Movies from mymovies.dk, I am able to do lossless streaming of my Blu-ray and DVD collection
for
the movies I have on my server, and it gives me a Kaleidoscape-like interface, and I love that. However, for FLAC, I don't believe there's native FLAC support in Windows anything, so I'd either have to hack something in for that, or I would look for something else. So I'm also using a cable card tuner, and that's the other reason I stick with Windows Media Center. I've yet to find another media app, all-encompassing app that will handle my Blu-ray collection and my FLAC audio collection and my cable card tuner and let me record. But if there's something out there that exists, I want to know about it, and I would love to hear about it, because I hate to keep mentioning Media Center all the time, but that is the app I use for the majority of what I watch TV for and how I record it, be it over the air or cable. It is free generally. I guess with Windows 8, it's $10 now, but no big whoop, and it does work, and you get free channel guide data too. However, I will say, just off the top of my head, I did happen to test the built-in tuner in that F8500 Samsung. It was very, very sensitive for considering the environment I was in, and I was really pleased with how Samsung does their channel guide information built into the TV as it pulls that data over the air. It's a good experience, although. Oh, I want to say you're now able, at least on that TV and probably their LCD as well, you're able to connect external storage for recording. And I wasn't sure if that was...
Oh, man, that's cool.
I was like, oh, wait, it says attach a hard drive. And I'm like, really? I'm like, okay, this could get interesting. And that's something I'm going to bring my hard drive in with me, or at least a large USB key to plug into the TV just to see if I can record a couple of shows, because that's interesting to me.
That's very interesting. I think that's the first time I've heard of a TV that lets you hang storage off of it to record stuff.
It's been a while. I mean, I remember when I want to say it was an LG TV a long time ago that had a built-in DVR, but and a cable card tuner, which is something
you've never seen. You're exactly right. I had forgotten.
But no, you're right. And I'd be curious to see, too. I want to say that Samsung has FLAC file support, but don't quote me on that one yet. I'm trying to remember now if I'm wishful thinking it or if that's an actual thing.
Right. Well, before we go on, I do want to thank our other sponsor for this show, which is ProXPN. ProXPN is a global VPN, virtual private network. It works with just about any internet connection. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes. And what could be more important in these days of government spying? It disguises your physical location and gives you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. So that's extremely important. You get complete online privacy through a 512-bit encryption tunnel. Works via OpenVPN or PPTP, you choose. Protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule and keep your personal internet usage private at work. I couldn't imagine anything more important there. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites and geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. ProXPN makes your internet connection truly region-free. It's available for Windows and Mac, and it offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. Also works on iOS and Android devices, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy. They offer world-class customer support, and I know that Steve Gibson here at Twit took a look at it and gave it a great review on Security Now. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we've got a special offer just for you. Use the promo code HTG and receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's not 1 month. It's not a year. The entire lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code HTG. We thank ProXPN very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. Now, we've got a few more questions here. I had one that I really wanted to check with. Oh, here we go, from Arthur D. What do you know about Dolby Height or ProLogic 2Z? My receiver decodes this, but I've never heard of it anywhere else.
Well, I know what, neither have I.
I know what it is.
Oh, good. I'm glad you do. I'm going to the browser right now.
Yeah, okay. Basically, what Dolby ProLogic 2Z does is it addresses not only a 7.1 surround sound around you, that is front, right, left, and center, side surrounds right and left, rear surrounds right and left. It also addresses front, what are called height speakers. Now, to use this, you need two extra speakers mounted high up on the wall. And this may be why you've never heard of it before, because it has a very strongly negative spousal acceptance factor, or SAF, as we call it. You need to have 9 speakers in your room in order to make use of Dolby ProLogic 2Z. Now, in addition, there are no Blu-rays or other sources that actually have 9 discrete main channels of audio. So what it does is it actually synthesizes those height channels. And Odyssey makes a similar system called DSX, which gives you these height channels and also what are called the front wide channels. So these two extra speakers are outside of the boundaries of the front, right, and left, but they're sort of more or less in front of you as opposed to the side surrounds. So with Odyssey DSX, you can get an 11.1 surround sound system. But talk about a negative spousal acceptance factor. Holy smokes. You know, if you live alone or you have a dedicated room that your spouse has said, do whatever you want, and they don't mind you spending the money, then by all means, get height speakers to put in front of you. Get wide speakers to put to the side of you. Dolby ProLogic 2Z does not deal with wide speakers, only with height speakers. But that's what it is. And it's fun to play with if you can afford and have domestic tranquility by putting these extra speakers into your room. But I don't know very many people who actually do.
It looks like, too, it's featured on some higher-end AVRs, too, or preamped AVRs.
Right.
I don't know. It seems like it's a premium option from Dolby compared to some of the other stuff. But
well, it is. It is, but I think it can come along for the ride pretty easily. Just like 3D is a feature now on TVs that many of them have. It's almost not a premium feature anymore. I mean, it's not on the bottom end of a product line, but and smart TV functionality, you're not going to see that on the very bottom line of TVs, but most of a manufacturer's TVs are going to have it. Similarly, I'd say receivers from the mid-range and up are going to may have 2Z. I don't know. Robert, you're just getting the Yamaha 575. Does that have 2Z?
Yeah, you know. Now I'm suddenly wondering. Let me see. Scrolling down to features, Dolby, blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's not going to tell me, is it?
It may not.
It shows me like every other. Hey, it has that sound optimization for automatic speaker setup, and it has MHL.
Oh, well, that's pretty cool.
I do like MHL.
Multi-channel. That's the
mobile
version
high definition
of HDMI.
Link.
Mobile high definition link. I was trying to think what it stood for. But yeah, that lets you plug in
your phone, essentially,
and use that
as a source device. And right. It converts. It's what it is. It's a cable agnostic HDMI bridge. So basically, it takes the micro USB out of the bottom of my phone, runs it on essentially what looks like a USB cable, but the other end has an HDMI link on it, and the electrical signaling can get translated. It's going through the wire. I mean, it is HDMI on one end and USB on the other, but it's able to provide that audio video experience over that cable. And if it's an MHL enabled device, you also get charging for your mobile device while it's plugged in. So
that's the other
handy part.
Yes, it gives you some power, whereas HDMI itself does not.
Totally. And I was hoping it might become like a cool way to turn more phones and more smart devices into either just sources for TVs that you plug them into, but also maybe even for gaming, because they all have Bluetooth enabled. There are, at least on my Android phone, there are apps for using your PS3 controller that's Bluetooth enabled with the phone, and the potential's there, but nobody's really put it all together yet, at least in terms of the controls needed in the games you end up playing on a mobile device. Usually it's optimized for you tapping on a screen rather than using a controller with it. So you end up with, you know, it's not ideal. It's like, oh, you have to go through a lot of hoops in order to get the controls mapped properly and other aspects to make it work. But as far as just connecting it from the phone to the TV, it's awfully handy, and it works pretty well. And I think it might be good for people who travel a lot, too. If you can carry that cable with you, throw it in your bag, then you can just connect your phone to your TV in the hotel room or wherever and, you know, stream a little Netflix, stream a little whatever, and enjoy.
Well, isn't that what the Chromecast is about?
Totally. And however, yes, especially if you're – I don't know how easy – I read a story that made – the traveling aspect of that kind of difficult because of the initial setup on the wireless network. There's no way to enter a password directly. You almost need like a browser screen when you're traveling in order to make that first connection to the internet with a wireless device. And unless you have that browser screen available, you can't enter the code or the password in order to get it all working. Likewise, too, I think it's just if you're dealing with a smart TV, like I mentioned, and it has the apps built in, you can do that pretty much without a Chromecast today. So I love my Chromecast, but I have it plugged into a TV that also has most of those apps already on it. So it is kind of duplicating function. And since it's currently really only supporting – Chromecast is only really supporting Netflix, YouTube, and Google Play,
right.
Until they add more stuff, like the ability just to show my web browser or run arbitrary pictures and video to the device, then it's going to explode. But until that happens, I'm kind of like, it's cool. And I was able to get it with that discount, or at least the bundled package that gives you 3 months of Netflix with it, which was nice. So it really reduced the cost of the device down to about $9, which can't really go wrong with that. So
yeah, exactly. Cool Breeze in the chat room is asking, for better Wi-Fi reception, sometimes you need to change physical location. Do you see any downside to using a Chromecast with an HDMI extension cable? Have you tried that?
Yeah, it comes with one. Because in case if you plug it in the back of the TV and all the metal on the back of your TV is interfering with the Wi-Fi signal, there's just an HDMI extension cord for that. But it's when you're roaming, and the initial setup can be problematic unless you have direct access to the access point. And unless it's wide open Wi-Fi, in which case you shouldn't have any problems getting it linked up. I was also trying today to have my friend link his iPhone to my Chromecast, and there's no Chromecast app yet for iOS.
Really? So, I thought there was.
So the setup is convoluted. Actually, if you're going to set one up, you have to do it through a web browser. It says coming soon on the Google page, at least when I checked it earlier today. But having it set up on my phone, linked to it, then I was like, oh, can't my friend just, since it's already set up, you think they would be able just to turn on the phone, the icon would appear, it's on the same wireless network, and have it work, and it didn't. And I'll have to experiment with that a little more. I actually ended up finding my iPhone 4, that's my old iPhone 4, and I'll put that to good use later, trying that out a little bit to see if I can get it working or come up with a better workaround at least.
Right. Okay, let's see if we can get through a couple other questions. Weirdo23 is asking, I have an Onkyo THX home theater in a box. The speakers were cosmetically damaged in a move. If I replace them with the Andrew Jones Pioneer speakers, which are really, really good, will I lose anything since they aren't matched to the THX receiver? I don't think so. Do you?
I wouldn't think so either. If it's a quality speaker engineered properly and it doesn't have like a chunk of metal stuck on the magnet or something else that could physically damage it, a screw that got dropped into the speaker during manufacture. Right. It's like, what is that sound? Right. No, it should sound great. The fact that you have a certified amp or certified AVR, that's a good start because at least it says that somebody went through that at some point and tested all the outputs on it, made sure that everything's pretty much in spec. So that's an ideal product to connect to just about any speaker set and to test to give it the full quality that you could expect. So,
and the other good thing about Onkyo home theater in a box systems in particular, this isn't true of most others, is that they give you a real Onkyo AV receiver. In many cases, it's kind of it's an AV receiver, but it's very, very limited, and it may have specialized speaker terminal connections that only work with their speakers and their wires. But the Onkyo systems, I know for a fact, at least the ones I've seen, are regular Onkyo AV receivers. They might have a slightly different model number because they're in a package, but they're basically the same thing. And so I would have no doubt that it would work great and that the Pioneer Andrew Jones design speakers would sound great, really great. Ooh.
Sounds like ear candy to me.
Yeah. Okay, Caffeine-Free Dave has asked for a while here. I asked on the last Twitch if my LG 47 LE8500, I want to use a pair of headphones along with Turtle Beach Earforce DSS2 Dolby Surround processor to get simulated 5.1. Turtle Beach says optical out needs to pass through DDL, though. Does it pass DDL through the optical out, the LG 47 LE8500. I don't know. Do you?
The LE8500. Is he talking Dolby Digital?
That's what it looks like. I'm assuming.
There's an option for that. Just about every TV I encounter is set by default to output PCM audio. And you have to have a Dolby Digital source playing, usually, in order for that option to even become enabled for you to switch it. But if you have that source going, or it could even be a tuner channel so much, you should be able to go into the audio setup and change it from PCM audio to Dolby Digital. And
I don't know about this TV in particular, but I know that a lot of TVs, their optical digital out will only do two channel. It won't do multi-channel. I don't know about this particular TV. And maybe the thing to do, obviously, as Robert, as you said, was to go into the settings, the audio settings, and see if you can set the output to do Dolby Digital out.
Totally. And in the case, you're right, though, about the stereo output, except for the built-in DTV tuner. If you're using that as the source, that should provide full surround sound for this. Most stations are broadcasting in Dolby Digital now. That, and I would also think that it probably isn't happening, though, say if you had a connected Blu-ray player, which to me is a little ridiculous. I mean, two things I would love to see happen on TVs just across the board. One, the picture-in-picture function, which I'm surprised how many people ask me about this, but
I am too.
People, you should be able to take any two inputs or whatever and swap them at will and do whatever you like in terms of what's showing where. I can't think of a reason why that doesn't exist. And everything that's and it should be also a third thing should be, it should auto HDMI switch, and it should provide pass through the HDMI or through the optical output for all connected devices for full quality. Or if it's going from, say, a lossless format to Dolby Digital, so be it. But still at least maintain 5.1 if it's there. Why that isn't, we should all be rioting in the streets.
Occupy.
I think about this every time I look at a new TV. I'm like, there's something that hasn't changed. So.
Yeah, would that it did. Well, we've come to the end of a great hour. I want to thank you so much for being here and helping me answer all these questions from the chat room. Robert Herron, co-host of HD Nation on Revision 3 and technologist extraordinaire at herronfidelity.com. Thank you so much.
Scott, it's been a pleasure. It's always a pleasure hanging out with you and talking tech and just home theater in general.
Are you going to Cedia?
No. Where is it now? Is it back in Colorado?
Denver, yeah. It's in Denver for this year and next year, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to go next year then for sure. I love it when it's in Denver. And Denver has to be one of the best cities to work in. How that city's laid out and the ability to get around town, it's fantastic. They have a free shuttle system that crosses the town, and you can pretty much stay anywhere in that city and get to anywhere else in about 15 minutes. And it makes it a pleasure. And it's only 2 hours flying from where I'm at. So
Me too.
Beats when it was back east a little further. I think it was in Atlanta a couple of years ago, and that was the last one I attended.
Well, for the next 2 years, it's in Denver, and then watch out, it's in Dallas.
Ooh.
Which is going to be really humid in September, I'm sure. Anyway. Anyway, I just wanted to know if you were going to be there. I definitely want to, connect, but next year maybe, huh?
Indeed.
And certainly, we'll love to have you come back on the show sometime soon, so we'll look forward to that.
Thank you.
And like I said, you can follow Robert at herronfidelity.com and also on his podcast, HD Nation, at revision3.com. Oh, Robert, what's your Twitter handle?
At Robert Herron. Real complicated.
Easy.
It's too
sure
long.
To follow him on Twitter.
Please do. I love Twitter. It's I love getting questions from people, and it's a good way for me to just interact and respond on a fairly timely basis. Although if it's a long question, just send me an email or send an email off to the show. Don't try to compress a story into, 140
characters. Right.
And we'll use it. We'll answer it.
Very good. Okay. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can always find past episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Tile Hertzens of innerfidelity.com to talk about his favorite subject, headphones. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.